We continue with the press conference held Monday in Moscow with Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov.
Natalia Yurova, Channel 1 TV station. U.S. President Donald Trump said last week defiantly that it's the last time that it extends the freeze on Iran sanctions. What are the consequences?
We have responded to this situation. We believe that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action on the Iranian nuclear program is one of the biggest achievements of the international community as far as stabilizing the situation in the Middle East is concerned. And it is absolutely necessary to deter the process of erosion of the non-proliferation regime. We have made our position known to the United States repeatedly. When we first heard doubts from Washington regarding the need to maintain the Comprehensive Action Plan on the Iranian nuclear program, together with the Chinese and European partners in this deal, we told Washington that we believe such an approach would be destructive and will result in unpredictable consequences. Unfortunately, our calls remained unheeded, and so far we were unable to make the United States change its point of view. We will continue insisting that the United States should recognize the reality. And the reality is that Iran has been abiding by its obligation under the nuclear deal, as verified by the IAEA Director General. The IAEA did not have any complaints about Iran on compliance. Now, what the United States is trying to accomplish is basically change the text of the agreement by including provisions which would be totally unacceptable for Iran, and we will never support that. Access to any facility immediately whenever required, this goes beyond the existing agreement. Unlimited denial of Iran's rights under the Non-Proliferation Treaty in the IAEA Charter. And at the same time, there is an attack on Iran generally. The United States wants Iran to stop developing ballistic missiles, which has never been a subject of talks, and Iran has never made any such commitments. And more abstractly, they want Iran to stop meddling in other countries' affairs in the region and stop violating human rights at home. And now there is a whole package of sanctions to be imposed on Iran being prepared, including these so-called violations that go beyond the nuclear deal. This is deplorable because in just a few months we'll have another review, and if the United States decides to escalate, I don't even want to think about consequences, because Iran will think it is no longer bound by the Comprehensive Joint Action Plan. I really hope that our European partners, and of course the Americans, are going to put a lot of pressure on them right now. I really hope that they will abide by the Comprehensive Action Plan, which was approved by the UN Security Council resolution, which is binding for all the parties. It is deplorable that the United States once again gave us reason to believe that they're unreliable. And as one of the basic consequences, again, I go back to the nuclear problem of the Korean Peninsula. If they want Kim Jong-un to suspend his military nuclear program, offering to lift sanctions. This was the essence of the deal between the international community and Iran. So if this treaty is now cancelled and Iran is told that it should abide by its commitments and sanctions will be reimposed, what would you do if you were the leader of North Korea? They say they will lift sanctions if North Korea suspends its military nuclear program, but then the next day they can cancel their promise, take it back. By the way, today in Vancouver, there will be a meeting on North Korea called by the US and Canada, including countries that were members of the UN-led coalition during the Korean War of 1950-1953. When we found out about this meeting, we asked, why do you need all those countries together? Greece, Belgium, Colombia, Luxembourg, what do they have to do with the Korean Peninsula today? And what are they going to do there at this conference? The Americans told us, first of all, this is important because we want to expand support for our joint efforts. And when we asked them about the agenda, they said the agenda is to come up with a mechanism for additional pressure on Pyongyang. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was another resolution passed, and in 2 days, they say that they will call this meeting in Vancouver. Russia and China were not invited, but they told us that this meeting will start later today and then on 16th. And you can come, Russia and China can come on the evening on 16th, and we will tell you what we have worked out. We said this was unacceptable, and we insisted that the UN should not accept invitation to this meeting as well. So, speaking of the methods and the manners of American diplomats, I think yesterday or the day before there was a briefing at the State Department, and there was a question asked when, why did you decide not to invite Russia and China to this conference in Vancouver? And the answer the spokesperson gave was evasive, but the essence was that we discussed this with Moscow and Beijing, and both countries support these efforts, support this conference. This is an outright lie. We openly said that we think this meeting is harmful. So let's wait and see. But at this point, it's hard for me. I don't know what the European countries' position will be like. I think they're suggesting looking for a compromise, so I think gradually the situation may deteriorate.
Anna Usanova, Moscow Baku News Agency. Mr. Lavrov, 2017 saw a strong contribution to the peace process in Syria made by Russia and a peacekeeper generally. Has Russia contributed to resolving the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict? Do you have any plans for it to be resolved this year? And my second question is, will you have any cooperation plans with Azerbaijan in 2018?
As far as Nagorno-Karabakh conflict is concerned, Russia cannot have any specific plans for this problem because this problem can only be resolved by the parties themselves. Russia and the United States and France are three co-chairmen of the Minsk OSCE group. We've been doing our best to provide conditions for such a settlement. We've been working hard in recent years to analyze the positions of all the parties and find the points where they coincide, things that they have in common. And at the same time, point out compromises that can bring the parties together on the issues where they disagree. This work has been going on intensely, including in the past year, and all of our proposals, all the proposals by the co-chairmen, and we share the same position, Russia, the United States, and France. Our position has been made known to the parties. They are aware of our position, but it's up to the parties to decide. Of course, we expect some positive impulses to come from both countries. We're happy that last year there was a direct meeting between the presidents, between the foreign ministers, representatives of the co-chairman countries were present at those meetings. Now it would be important to take specific actions to calm down the situation along the disengagement line. This would help us to move on to political settlement. And as a general comment, I can say that this problem cannot be solved once and for all in one document. You need a stage-by-stage approach. Stage-by-stage approach, which would reflect agreements on what is possible today and outline what needs to be done further to address outstanding issues so that one day the final solution can be achieved, including the status of Nagorno-Karabakh. So it's up to the parties. And you also asked about our joint plans with Azerbaijan. Our relations with Azerbaijan are based on extensive dialogue between the presidents and foreign ministers. We paid visits to each other this year. We have humanitarian events going on a regular basis, including the humanitarian forum and many other things. Our trade has been growing, mutual investment. So this work is happening in a natural way, and it doesn't require any additional documents regulating it. We have bilateral commissions in different areas with their roadmaps, and we are very happy with our strategic partnership with Azerbaijan.
RT. Илья Петренко, RT. I would like you to comment on the situation with Mr. Assange. It might seem that everyone's forgotten about him, but it's not so. All the legal efforts by Ecuador have not worked. Political first, they've provided shelter, then he got the status of a political refugee, and then they wanted to give him diplomatic status, but London said no, so nothing works. It will soon be 6 years that this human rights champion and whistleblower has been holed up in the embassy of Ecuador. And a separate question, in a similar situation, would Russia provide shelter to Assange? There have been also attempts to disrupt the Syrian National Dialogue Congress. Just recently, a U.S. State Representative said that it will not acknowledge the legitimacy of this platform. Will we listen to the U.S.? Will we be able to hold this Congress on time, given the disagreements between the guarantors and between other international players, and also the issue around Kurds, and also the participation of Mr. Demistura.
What was your first question about? Oh, Julian Assange. You know, it's a hypothetical question. What would Russia do if Assange were to ask for Russian citizenship? We treat these situations from the humanitarian point of view. First and foremost, this is what happened with Edward Snowden. He asked for asylum. We provided asylum for Snowden. And part of the reasoning was what would happen to him because of the charges brought against him in the United States. So he's been living and working here, and his position is very non-conformist. He speaks openly about whatever he likes. So I cannot comment on Julian Assange. Julian Assange is not in the Russian Federation right now. Of course, this problem needs to be resolved one way or another. I totally agree with that. And we understand what Ecuador does and support their actions. I hope that all the other players will also follow common sense, including our British colleagues and our colleagues in Sweden. I think they're even ready to show goodwill and resolve this problem. Now, as regards what our American partners say about the Astana process and the Syrian National Dialogue Congress, we invited the United States to Astana, and they took part in the Astana meetings a number of times. They sent their envoy from the State Department in Washington. You know, I would be happy if the Geneva process would proceed ahead at full steam. Unfortunately, the initial attempt to limit the Geneva process to talks between the government and immigrants, political emigres, without including forces inside Syria, opposition forces inside Syria, I think this approach was doomed to fail. Yes, we were part of those meetings, but we said from the very beginning that the UN resolution demands that the entire spectrum of political movements in Syria should be included, and people who have been living abroad for many years cannot represent the entire spectrum. This is where the Astana process came from. People who oppose the government, armed opposition, they are the ones that need to be brought to the negotiating table to work out a ceasefire agreement and come up with a joint action plan to make arrangements for de-escalation zones. Likewise, with the Syrian National Dialogue Congress, which is expected to use the situation once ISIS has been largely defeated and dismantled to get as many people as possible involved in this process. People who are not covered by Geneva structures, and this is a majority if you take all the Syrian parties. And after this Congress, we think the UN should be grateful to us because we will only facilitate and broaden the scope of participants, and this will help with constitutional reforms and with future elections to ensure universal support of the Syrian people, and not just the ones who met in the Palace of Nations in Geneva.
I will go first in English, if that's okay, and then in Russian. In light of the events that you've mentioned, with sanctions being tightened, with the loss of your diplomatic compounds and investigations underway into alleged Russian meddling in the United States, the current relationship between Russia and the US seems possibly worse than under President Obama. After 1 year of President Trump and considering the possibility of additional sanctions in the coming weeks and months, do you personally ever regret the day that Donald Trump became president? And do you ever wish that Hillary Clinton were sitting in the White House instead?
You know, this is not what diplomats do. Regretting about things that have happened. We work with facts, and facts are what we have today. So we just do what needs to be done to advance Russia's interests under current circumstances.
Mr. Lavrov, is there a way for is there anything that the Syrian diplomats could have done to resolve the crisis? And I have a second question, not on Italy, but on Vatican. Cardinal Pietro Parolini visited Russia in August. Will we have any other major breakthroughs between Russia and Vatican coming next?
On Libya, you know, we don't play the leading role in international efforts on Libyan settlement. As you know, there was an international meeting in Paris between Mr. Sarraj and Marshal Haftar. And we saw some encouraging results after this meeting, even though there was not much progress after that. We also think that efforts by neighboring countries, Algeria, Egypt, and Tunisia, are quite constructive. And we also support what Mr. Salama, UN Special Envoy, does, coming up with a roadmap, at least few rounds of talks that he presided over in Tunisia, gives us reasons to believe that slowly but surely the situation is moving in the right direction, including preparations for the election. Everybody agrees that this will be a very important step. As for us specifically, unlike many other countries, from the very beginning we've been working with all the parties in Libya. We worked with the National Unity Government in Tripoli and with Tobruk, with Mr. Gvail and many others. At first, some of our Western colleagues only worked with one of those parties. Today, better late than never, as they say, today their approach is more balanced and they realize that it is necessary to bring all the key players in Libya to the negotiating table. Otherwise, it would be difficult to secure the result. As for our relations with the Vatican, even before this visit, our contacts have been quite intense. President Putin met with Pope Francis a number of times. And we have specific examples of working together in humanitarian contexts. We have unique exhibitions that we've exchanged. And last year, we have agreed on visa-free travel for the holders of diplomatic passports. Vatican described this agreement as historic. And we have a number of mutual interests, including things happening in the Middle East and Africa. We've been organizing special conferences together with Vatican to protect the rights of Christians in all those brutal conflicts. The last conference took place on the margins of the ministerial meeting of OSCE countries last December. These are just a few examples of our diverse ties with Vatican.
Ilta Sanomat from Finland. The so-called Russia-Finnish war, the Soviet-Finnish war, had a negative legacy on the relations between Russia and Finland. And there have been publications that Finnish historians cannot agree with. There have been some fake statements made about the war. Can you clearly say what is the opinion of the Russian Foreign Ministry? So, who started that 1939 war? Which side?
You know, let historians sort this out. I think diplomats should not express their positions on historical facts, which were not the best period for our relations. And currently, I think our relations are quite good. And on the whole, as far as the Winter War is concerned, I hope you were able to watch the film yesterday, Balam. I think the president said clearly there that we look to the future, we appreciate the role that Finland played in preserving the monastery and its treasures. And if we have diplomats arguing who started shooting first 70 or 80 years ago, I think this would be the wrong thing to do. It's something that historians should do. By the way, we have special commissions of historians with many countries, and I think it would be good to have a similar commission with Finland. Now, a question from Kazakhstan. Mr. Lavrov, a year ago, I asked you about European and Western countries and their response to the EAEU. You said that different countries have different reactions. So, what would you say this time? What do those countries think about the EAEU today? And my second question is about Uzbekistan. Last year, Uzbekistan changed its influences, its structure. What are your plans regarding Uzbekistan?
A year ago, the EU did not want to accept any positive outcome from the Eurasian Economic Union. But it's just like the NATO does not want to recognize the Collective Security Treaty Organization as a institution that it could have any partnership relations. This was a year ago. Brussels has moved forward in embracing the reality, and it is ready for dialogue between the Eurasian Economic Union and the European Union on technical issues. But they have to do with the transfer of goods, with the movement of goods, and this would certainly help to promote cooperation. We can start with this way, going from bottom up. What was your second question on Uzbekistan? We have allied relations with Uzbekistan, and this relationship has been reflected in our agreement. Uzbekistan has been taking a more active step in our joint efforts as part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as part of the CIS. Our two leaders discussed further steps to deepen our strategic cooperation and allied relations. And again, this is roughly the same as what we've been doing as part of our multilateral cooperation. So we have very good prospects.
Question from Canadian media.
In English, Canada has suggested it might be prepared to be part of a peacekeeping mission in Ukraine if the peacekeeping mission involved all of eastern Ukraine, whereas I believe Russia's position is interest just along the contact line. Do you see any way of bridging those two positions? And I'll just come back to what you said about the North Korea meeting in Vancouver today. Do you think anything productive can come out of that without Russia there?
Again, Russia and China have not been invited, not just us. With all due respect to those who've arranged this meeting, I don't expect anything productive. I just hope that there would be nothing counterproductive. But we don't really believe that because the agenda says mounting increasing pressure on North Korea. Now, back to your question on Ukraine. We put forward an initiative to have a UN mission to secure the peacekeeping effort by the OSCE. But again, it's not just on the borderline. The OSCE team has a mandate. It can move around due to prior coordination. They move along both lines and they regularly come to the territory of Luhansk and Donetsk regions all the way up to the Russian border, and they might visit the territory near the Russian border up to 20 times a week. So according to our proposal, the UN peacekeepers will be deployed, will be embedded with the OSCE observers wherever they go in accordance with their mandate. You said that Canada has interest in sending its peacekeepers, but it's a question that should better address someone else. It's the combatants that have to define the composition of the peacekeeping force.
Staying with Ukraine, Roman Cymbaliuk. Mr. Lavrov, I would like to ask you about promises you give and then take back. You mentioned the agreement that was signed on in 2014. Why the medal for annexation of the Crimea is dated one day before this agreement was signed? And my second question, Vladimir Putin said last week that the Russian Federation is ready to return the armor and warships from the Crimea back to Ukraine. Could you please clarify? Because he also mentioned that after the situation in the Donbass, the relations between Russia and Ukraine will improve. So could you clarify how crucial it is for Russia to maintain those pseudo-states of Donetsk and Lugansk, because the Minsk agreements say nothing about People's Republics of Donetsk and Lugansk?
Well, it said some districts of the Lugansk and Donetsk region. Well, again, I'm talking to journalists. I'm not in a court meeting, so I can use free language. So it says some districts of the Lugansk and Donetsk regions. Now, in terms of commitments, first you have some of the items on ending violence, hostilities, pulling back weapons, and in a month, direct consultations between the Kyiv government and the representatives of some districts of the Lugansk and Donetsk regions should start on preparations for election. So it says direct consultations. Well, Ukraine continues to say that it has not taken up that commitment and is trying to find new arrangements that, you know, it should only talk to the French, to Germans, to the OSCE, to Russia, that it basically ignores those regions. So when it all happened, Russia handed over the weaponry back in March, but then Kyiv launched an anti-terrorist operation, calling terrorists those people who have never been terrorists. But we did not hand over the weapons back then because we realized that those weapons could be used against the people who have defiantly said no to the coup. Yeah. We didn't want to give weapons to those who've put a crackdown on the Russian language and who said that Russians should be kicked out of Crimea. And Mr. Yarosh, he said that. He's the author of that quote, and he was the firebrand at those Maidan protests. So Crimea had another way to defend their culture, their multi-ethnic identity and diversity. So we are definitely interested in the full implementation of the Minsk Accords. As for the medal for the for Crimea, well, I've not seen that medal. I'm sure it's a technical fault.
Mr. Lavrov, Sputnik News Agency, I would like to ask you about Poland. Russia and Poland are neighbors, but Warsaw has a lot of claims and grievances with Moscow. It's almost an endless list. I don't know if I should go over all those complaints. Moscow keeps saying that Warsaw is a partner. Warsaw describes Russia as an enemy. How should we build relations with such a difficult partner as Poland? This is my first question, and if I may, I would also like to ask the second question about France. You mentioned the French initiative of fighting fake news. If this is converted into an actual bill, do you think this will be used primarily against Russian media?
From what I understand, it's only you and RT that have not been recognized as true journalists by the French president and have not been allowed to be part of the presidential pool. And I guess that you were one of the reasons why that bill is now being debated. But, you know, the bill addresses the fake news in general. And again, there will be just one authority that will define what is fake news and what is not fake news. So it's like a judge deciding without listening to the testimony of the witnesses or to those in the dock. Liberal Democrats, they say, know best how to do it. It's not a direct quote, but that's the bottom line of what has been said. So they have three types of countries: liberal democracies, non-liberal democracies, and authoritarian regimes. So they say that liberal Democrats know better. So we'll need wait and see what transpires out of it. Now back to Poland. I think we need to remain a balanced approach in relations with Poland. We've been always ready for a pragmatic cooperation. We've always had extensive cultural ties. We've had many festivals, cinema festivals, singing contests. We've had joint movie productions. And I think that spoke volumes about the close relationship between our people. People are not engaged in politics, ordinary people. But you're right, we are branded as enemies. We don't want to use a reciprocal approach, but we're seeing that Poland is trying to promote Russophobia as a national idea. They are trying to tear down monuments to Russian soldiers. They say it's their right to tear them down. But we do have an intergovernmental agreement that makes sure that all monuments are protected and maintained. There are other issues. We know what role Poland plays in NATO or in the EU. It counters any proposals on a more realistic relationship with Russia. But again, we are ready for dialogue. But for that, our Polish counterparts need to realize that dialogue has to be a two-way street. They cannot dictate to us anything based on the tacit support from Washington and other hawks from NATO.
Question from Belarusian media. Belarusian public television. Mr. Lavrov, you had a meeting with your colleague last year, and you described the work you do together in terms of visa facilitation. Will you be able to complete this process in time for the World Cup? And an even bigger question, as part of these talks, or maybe some other talks, have you discussed certain differences as far as border control is concerned? It's been about a year where Russia has a full-blown passport control, not just at international crossings, but also at the Moscow-Brest highway. People have their passports checked at airports and train stations. Is there any hope that our border, which supposedly should not exist, which still does exist, will become actually transparent, as our presidents agreed over 20 years ago?
If it only depends on us, then yes. But in order to make the border transparent, we need to sync our efforts. And it applies to anything. If we talk about the lives of people as part of our joint state. So when Belarusians stay in Russian hotels and Russians stay in Belarusian hotels, they should pay the same amount as the citizen of the country, not higher as foreigners. The same situation should be also applied to spa resorts. So, you know, there are some inequalities, but we favor a no-border approach, and there have been no borders, but we are now facing a difficult situation in terms of a terrorist threat. But without any warning, our Belarusian counterparts said that 80 countries can bring their citizens without any visas for several days. Well, that decision confused the situation a little bit, because with some of the countries we have a visa regime and we make lengthy checks before we allow their citizens to move in. So there is a situation when a foreigner would enter Belarus and then they would move to Russia without any visa, without any checks. So we were forced to do what we had. What we did, we warned everyone, if you want to move from Belarus to Russia, and if you're a foreigner, you have to be checked. And if you're taking a plane from Belarus to Russia, then you can only come to an airport where you have an international customs zone and border control. We don't want any unilateral action. It has to be a two-way street. This is why we said that we need to harmonize the agreements on visas, and we've made very good headway on that.
Петр Козлов, BBC. Mr. Lavrov, late last week, the Russian Foreign Ministry announced that British media prepared a smear campaign against the World Cup in Russia. Could you please give us some more details about that? Because we in the British media know nothing about that. So what exactly did you have in mind? And my second question, if I may, there will be a presidential election in March, and there will be a new cabinet formed. So do you have any plans for the future? If you leave your job, who do you think can be the new foreign minister in Russia? Thank you.
Welcome. As for your first question, Guardian had just recently published a piece that something's wrong again, and our spokesperson also reported on that. As for our March election, we have a constitution that has a clear procedure for the government to be set up, and we'll comply with that procedure. As for me, I have always worked hard to do what I have been doing. This is my main mission.
Mr. Lavrov, Mia Russia Сегодня, Latin American branch, Sputnik. We know that you've been doing this work. As you know, Sputnik is has heavy presence in this region, and we talk to experts, we talk to people there, and they want to have more cooperation with Russia. They say that this is particularly important today because under the current U.S. administration, relations between Latin America and the U.S. is not that great. So my question to you is Russia interested in working closer together with Latin America? Are there any particular projects that you can mention as an example?
We do have interest, and we have a lot of new projects. We have regular summits, and we are waiting the Argentinian president, and eight Latin American teams have made it to the World Cup that will be taking place in Russia. We hope that we'll have vast delegations that will come, and that will help us to develop our ties in political, economic, and cultural areas. With the exception of 4 to 5 countries, we have a visa-free regime, and I'm sure that in the next 2 years, the entire CELAC zone will be visa-free for Russia. We had a visit from CELAC delegation 18 months ago. We approved a roadmap to promote our cooperation. We are also working with sub-regional organizations, including ALBA, Mercosur, the ANSC Pact. And some other organizations. So we do have very good bilateral relations with almost all countries. Our turnover with Latin America is more than $10 billion, and that's high-tech products mainly. That's defense products, space, including land equipment for a GLONASS system, nuclear energy, and other projects. So a lot has been done, but there's still a lot of new projects in any of the areas. And we're also closely cooperating at the UN with a vast majority of Latin American countries. We have shared positions on all the UN-related issues. We jointly favor respect for the UN Charter. We try to push for every conflict to be resolved on the basis of international law. And you know that Latin America has a principle that is almost a law. It's unacceptable to support any unconstitutional coups. And that's a key plank that is part of foreign policy of many Latin American countries. And we supported an initiative when the UN General Assembly made it a formal principle that it's unacceptable to support any coups.
Hello, Mr. Lavrov, a question from Itartas. I have two brief questions. The first has to do with the intention of the United States to meet with the foreign ministers of Central Asian countries, former Soviet republics. in the 5+1 format. What do you think about this initiative? And do you think that this may be a sign of anti-Russian intentions in the region? My second question has to do with the Global Young Diplomat Forums. The first one took place in Sochi last year. What do you think about the prospects of this initiative? And about the prospects of setting up the International Association of Young Diplomats?
Well, we do have a plan in response to your second question. If young diplomats from other countries support this, we'd only welcome this move. As for the relations between the U.S. and Central Asian countries, the U.S. is not the only country that has been developing several ties. There is a similar platform with the EU, with China, possibly with Iran. Now, back to your question on the U.S. We have nothing against our Central Asian neighbors and partners have a diverse spectrum of foreign partners, but we hope that this would be done with respect to the Collective Security Treaty Organization, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and Eurosec, and other commitments. We are aware of the fact that the U.S. would like to abuse that format or to exploit for their own agenda. The previous U.S. administrations had a big project for the Grand Central Asia. All the Central Asia projects should be centered around southern areas like Afghanistan, but they should bypass Russia. If these projects are promoted during their contacts with our Central Asian friends, then all of them will see that these attempts are very much detrimental, and they do not correspond to the interests of infrastructure interests or to the interests of Central Asian partners, but they're only driven by the U.S. foreign policy interests. We pursue a completely different policy. We do not want to isolate anyone. We would like to move forward with integration process gradually, and the ultimate goal is to have everyone working together. Thank you.